Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. French President François Hollande vowed Friday to crush the army of fanatics who carried out this month's deadly terror attacks in Paris as he presided over a national memorial service for the victims. The commemoration, held at Paris's Invalides National Monument, began with a somber reading of the names and ages of the 130 people who died in the attacks claimed by the Islamic State group.
Stéphane Alati, 39 ans.
Nick Alexander, 35 ans.
Jean-Jacques Amiot, 68 ans.
It has been 2 weeks since the team of Islamic State militants swept through Paris, setting off their suicide vests and opening fire on innocent victims in several locations, including a crowded concert hall. The ceremony was also attended by other top French leaders and families of victims, as well as hundreds of those injured in what was France's worst ever terrorist attack. German police said Friday they've released two men arrested a day earlier on suspicion of planning a serious attack against the state. Police told local media no evidence was found to hold the men, who were detained on the outskirts of Berlin following a raid on an Islamic cultural center. Following the raid, authorities cleared the area surrounding the men's vehicle, which was said to contain a suspicious object. The item turned out to be harmless, and no weapons or explosives were found. Authorities say the men are aged 28 and 46, but have not released their identities or information on their alleged plot. They say an investigation is ongoing. Look at our website at VOA News. This is VOA News. The war of words between Russia and Turkey over the downing of a Russian warplane continued Friday, with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan warning Moscow not to play with fire. During a speech in the northeastern Turkish city of Beyrut, Erdogan accused Russia of playing with fire by attacking groups opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad under the pretext of fighting the Islamic State group, and by irresponsibly targeting trucks operating inside Syria for commercial activities or humanitarian aid. Turkey's state-run news agency and a Turkish relief group reported Wednesday that Russian aircraft attacked a Turkish aid convoy inside Syria near the Turkish border, killing 7 people and wounding 10. Russia reacted angrily after Turkish fighter jet shot down the warplane Tuesday, threatening ties between two countries on opposite sides in the Syrian war and raising fears of a wider international conflict. The detention of two prominent journalists in Turkey has provoked national and international criticism. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Condemnation is growing over the jailing of two leading Turkish journalists. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the leader of the main opposition, Republican People's Party, described the arrest as a black day for democracy and freedom of press. The US Embassy, in a tweet, expressed great concern about what it said appears to be another media outlet under pressure. The editor of Turkey's Cumhuriyet newspaper, Can Dündar, and his Ankara bureau chief, Erdem Gül, are facing more than 20 years in jail on spying charges. Dündar, speaking before his trial on Thursday, expressed defiance. He said he and Gül are journalists, not traitors or spies. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Special forces in Mali have arrested two men in connection with last week's attack on a luxury hotel in Bamako that left 19 people dead. A statement from the military Friday said both men were arrested in Bamako and said questioning them will shed more light on the motivations of the attackers, but did not specify exactly how they are believed to be connected to the attack. Two West African militant groups claim joint responsibility for the November 20th attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel. Police in Bangladesh are trying to identify and track down the gunman who opened fire inside a Shiite mosque Thursday evening, killing one man and injuring 3 others. The U.S.-based Site Intelligence Group reports that the Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Malian authorities have arrested two men in connection with a terrorist attack that killed 22 people at an upscale Bamako hotel.
That's Katerina Hoya reporting from Bamako. Details coming up. Also in the news, Burkina Faso's government forces have thwarted a large-scale attack by terrorists. This just days before scheduled national elections. And on his final day in Nairobi, Pope Francis visited a slum and condemned what he called the injustices of urban poverty and substandard living conditions. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports, with Douglas and Puga sitting in for Sunny, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the Associated Press News Service says Burkina Faso's government forces have thwarted a large-scale attack by terrorists. This just days before scheduled national elections. Security Minister Alain Zagri has announced the arrest of 13 suspects and the seizure of weapons and bomb-making materials near the border with Mali. The minister says the suspects are from Burkina Faso and Mali, raising the possibility of the involvement of extremist group in Mali. The arrests were linked to the investigation of an attack on a military police post by 50 assailants last month near the Malian border. Burkina Faso has set up checkpoints at the entrances to cities and plans to close its border for Sunday's vote. The presidential election was previously scheduled for October. The vote was postponed in the wake of a September attempted coup by officers of the presidential guard. The coup failed and leaders are now facing court trials. In August, gunmen attacked another police post near Mali's border in August, and in April, a Romanian security officer was kidnapped from the northern Tambo mining site. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Murabitoun group claimed responsibility, the same group that said it carried out last week's hotel attack in Mali that killed 20. Malian authorities have arrested two men in connection with the terrorist attack that killed 22 people at an upscale Bamako hotel. Katerina Hoya has the latest for VOA from Bamako.
Amadou Sango of the Ministry for Security and Civil Protection says a cell phone found Thursday at a hotel led to arrest of two Malian men.
He
says this new piece of evidence, this item, we hope it will bring the investigation forward. He said the two suspects were picked up by Malian special forces in Bamako. Gunmen entered the Radisson Blue Hotel the morning of November 20, firing indiscriminately at guests and staff. Survivors says they then headed for the two uppermost floors, specifically looking for foreigners. Authorities still have not identified the bodies of the two gunmen killed during the siege. Sango said investigators are looking for accomplices. He hinted that several people are being questioned or investigated. Because the gunmen were killed in the attack, he says, we have to find those who assisted them or helped them plan the attack. To identify the two terrorists is our main priority, he said. Two jihadist groups in Mali have issued claims of responsibility for the attack. Sango says identifying the two gunmen will allow authorities to determine which group is behind the attack. He says, we need to know who these men are, what's the nationality, and why they did this, and who they are working for. American investigators from the Federal Bureau of Investigation are in Mali assisting with the investigation. Arms and ammunition recovered at the crime scene are being sent to an FBI laboratory in Virginia for further analysis. Katerina Hoya for VOA News, Bamako.
A solemn ceremony was held in Paris today to remember the victims of the terrorist attack that killed 130 people 2 weeks ago. The name of each of the victims was read aloud. The Associated Press News Service reports French President Hollande pledged to destroy the army of fanatics responsible for the attack. Seven attackers were killed on November 13th. Three other suspects died 5 days later. Two more are still at large. Much of the manhunt is taking place in neighboring Belgium. Hundreds of migrants in Greece stormed a barbed wire fence at the Macedonian border today. Many threw stones and demanded they be allowed to go to Germany. A few managed to break through the fencing before Macedonian security guards in riot gear blocked the gap in the fence. More than 1,500 migrants from Morocco, Algeria, and Pakistan have been trying to cross the Greek border at the city of Idomeni. The International Office for Migration says today more than 110,000 migrants and refugees have entered Greece by sea this month. More than 8,000 refugees and migrants from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia have arrived in Europe by sea since January. Turkey's state-run Anadolu news agency says six children drowned in the Aegean today. Two boats headed to Greek islands sank in bad weather. The United Nations has condemned the new restrictions on travel based on nationality, but Balkan governments have clamped down on a largely unchecked stream of migrants, leaving tens of thousands stranded in Macedonia, Serbia, and Croatia. You are listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Twelve past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Malian authorities have arrested two men in connection with the terrorist attack that killed 22 people at an upscale Bamako hotel. And a solemn ceremony was held in Paris today to remember the victims of the terrorist attack that killed 130 people 2 weeks ago. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. On his final day in Nairobi today, Pope Francis visited a slum and condemned what he called the injustices of urban poverty and substandard living conditions. He placed the blame on a selfish minority clinging to power and wealth. VOA's Jill Craig was there and has this report.
Speaking at the St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Parish in Nairobi's Kangemi slum, Pope Francis did not shy away from making his thoughts known on urban poverty.
Estoy aquí porque quiero que sepan que sus alegrías y esperanzas.
The Pope said he understands the difficulties the people face each day, as well as their hopes and sorrows. The crowd cheered as the Pope said that to deny a family water under any bureaucratic pretext whatsoever was a great injustice. He said lack of access to infrastructure and basic services is a serious problem. He included on this list toilets, trash collection, electricity, roads, schools, hospitals, sports centers, and even studios and workshops for artisans and craftsmen. The pontiff chastised what he called minorities who cling to power and wealth and selfishly squander. He said they force a growing majority to flee to substandard living quarters, even though God gave the earth to the whole human race without exclusion. Grace Jiroge attended the event and is glad the Pope highlighted the struggles of slum dwellers.
Because whatever Papa was saying is what has led Kenya to have so many slums because of this rat grabbing by private developers. And also you find that you cannot have access to water.
Pope Francis also praised the poor, whom he said the language of exclusion often disregards. He said they are able to weave bonds of belonging and togetherness, which convert overcrowding into an experience of community. From Kangemi, Pope Francis headed to a rally with thousands of youth at a sports stadium. The crowd cheered as he arrived in his Popemobile. The Pope took questions from young people and spoke off script. He urged them to resist corruption, comparing it to sugar, saying that one may develop a taste for it, but ultimately it's destructive. He also called for an end to tribalism, an issue that continues to plague Kenya, and he advocated for education and jobs as a way to prevent young people from being radicalized. Morris Karimi says he plans to heed the Pope's messages from the last 2 days.
The way he gives his speeches and the messages is quite convincing. Yeah, he'll have an influence on decision makers, and even upon myself as an individual, I am feeling influenced. And now I feel that I should mind more about the poor, mind about the environment, and fight for peace.
The Pope left Kenya Friday to visit Uganda, the second country, on his inaugural Africa tour. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Pope Francis is due to arrive Sunday in the Central African Republic, and UN agencies are using the occasion to call attention to the nation's problems. UNICEF, the UN's Children's Fund, estimates 1 million children are in need of humanitarian aid, and about half of those under the age of 5 are malnourished. It says 2 million children have been affected by sectarian violence over the past year. Insecurity and attacks on convoys have disrupted aid deliveries. The conflict has uprooted 400,000 people within the country and forced 500,000 to seek refuge in neighboring countries. Periodic sectarian violence has cast doubt on security for the Pope's visit. The clashes also risk derailing internationally backed elections scheduled for December 27th. Pope Francis took his message of caring for the planet to the offices of the UN Environment Programme in Nairobi and called for strong action ahead of the Paris Climate Summit. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga reports.
At the United Nations Environmental Programme headquarters in Nairobi Thursday, Pope Francis called for immediate action to stem climate change and protect the environment.
In this international context, we are confronted with a choice which cannot be ignored, either to improve or to destroy the environment.
Pope Francis further urged that the common good overcome selfish interests.
In a few days' time, an important meeting on climate change will begin in Paris, where the international community as such will once again confront these issues. It would be sad, and I dare say even catastrophic, were particular interests to prevail over the common good.
Akim Steiner, the executive director of UNEP, agrees with Pope Francis's desire to reach a sustainable agreement in Paris.
That approach has embedded climate change into the global consciousness, not just the science on harmful emissions and wasteful practices that contribute to them, but the well-being of a healthy planet that includes justice, equality, and solidarity with the most vulnerable in society. And the very people who are often the least responsible for the problem, but are the most affected by the consequences.
In his address at the United Nations compound in Nairobi, the Pope called for action against poaching and illegal mineral exploitation in Africa and called for, and I quote, a new energy system, end quote, reducing fossil fuels to the minimum and a rethink, and I quote, of the current model of development, end quote. The Paris conference, which begins Monday, hopes to achieve for the first time in over 20 years of United Nations negotiations a binding and universal agreement on climate from all the nations of the world. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report says birds are signaling that climate change poses a real threat. Bird Life International and the National Audubon Society say birds are sentinels for the natural world, and their message is clear and urgent. The organization's call on negotiators at the Paris Climate Conference to take that warning seriously. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
In the past, canaries were often used in coal mines as an early warning signal of a dangerous gas leak. Unfortunately for them, the signal was that they were dead at the bottom of a cage. Today, the warning comes in the form of their migrations, declining numbers, and disrupted interaction with the environment. BirdLife CEO Patricia Zarita says birds are the closest connection humans have to wildlife.
We in the conservation world are trying to protect elephants and rhinos and pandas and you name it, whales. But what do you see the minute that you actually wake up and step out of the door? Birds. That's the biggest and closest connection that you have from wildlife to you. And this is the best ambassador of the planet for us.
The new report is called The Messengers, what birds tell us about the threats from climate change. It's a compilation of work from nearly 120 researchers around the world.
It's the first ever global synthesis of multiple disciplines in every continent telling us the key impacts of climate change, both on people and nature. What is the projection of what's going to happen? And how can we make sure that while we're having the climate dialogue, we don't dismiss the opportunity of using nature-based solutions as a part of the process to ensure that we can adapt to a warmer planet?
Zarita says the study shows climate change will take its toll on birds and other species.
There's no question that there will be some species that will be able to adapt. When it gets warmer, birds and other type of wildlife will move higher in elevation, for example. So there will be some winners. In Europe, a lot of people are talking about one of the pros of climate change is the fact that they will be able to grow more grapes everywhere and they will have more wine. But the problem is that there's going to be a lot more losers than winners, and that's what we're looking at. Many species are not going to be able to adapt as fast as climate is changing, so populations will decline.
She says the interaction between some ecosystems and species is being disrupted.
For example, there are birds in the Arctic that lay their eggs and their chicks are born specifically at the time when insects are available. So the evolutionary actions have actually allowed those populations to be synchronized. Now with climate change, the synchronicity is failing. So the insects are coming much, much later than when the chicks are coming out.
The Messengers report recommends promoting clean energy, protecting and restoring carbon-rich ecosystems, and conserving and managing key ecosystems. Zarita describes the Paris Climate Conference as crucial to dealing with rising global temperatures.
Climate change is not something that only the scientists believe in. It's something that is happening right now. Climate change is going to get worse, and we have to pay attention, and the Paris Convention is absolutely crucial at this point. We are at a time when we need to take action. We have to have a global agreement to reduce emissions. We cannot keep letting the planet just get warmer and warmer.
The Paris Climate Conference, known as COP21, opens November 30th and concludes December 11th. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
New statistics from the United Nations aid agency show alarming new information in Africa, including a rise in adolescent deaths and new infections and low rates of infant testing. From South Africa, which has the world's highest burden of HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, VOA's Anita Powell brings us this report.
AIDS is now the leading cause of death for Africa's teenagers, a statistic that AIDS experts say is a huge setback in the fight against the virus. That adds up to a tripling of adolescent HIV deaths worldwide since 2000. The UN presented this and other disturbing data this week in Johannesburg as part of its global statistical update on AIDS among children. The study also found that globally, less than half of all infants are tested for HIV. The report also found some encouraging news, such as a 41% drop in new infections in Africa since the year 2000 and 34% fewer AIDS-related deaths in that 15-year time span. The UN also reported global success in preventing mother-to-child transmission of the virus. Dr. Pierre Somsa is deputy director of the UNAIDS Regional Support Team for Eastern and Southern Africa.
The face of our failure are children and adolescents. These are the face of our failure. So today, given this reality, we are at the intersection of time. We have the intersection of achievement, we have done well. We have an intersection of opportunities. So we have seen all this new innovation. We have seen the progress made in treatment. But we have also at the intersection of challenges, serious challenges.
The report says that half of the world's HIV-positive teens between the ages of 15 and 19 live in South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, Mozambique, Tanzania, and India. Craig McClure, UNICEF's Associate Director and Chief of HIV and AIDS, says most teens who die have simply been overlooked, a fact that shows a fatal and preventable flaw in governments and aid agencies' treatment plans.
Most of the AIDS-related adolescent deaths are among those that were born with HIV and received no diagnosis or no treatment, or children who were diagnosed were on pediatric treatment, but when they enter that difficult period of adolescence, where routine is so difficult, somehow slipped out of care in the transition from pediatric to adolescent programming, became sick and died.
17-year-old Mani Jalasen narrowly avoided that fate.
J'étais infectée à ma naissance. Quelle était ma faute?
Jalasen says she was infected at birth and rejects the shame that comes with the virus, saying it's not her fault, she was born with it. She also says stigma is one issue that drives teens away from treatment. Somsa says words like these are powerful ammunition in the war to eradicate the virus by 2030. Scientific research has shown success, he says, but the social aspects of the epidemic have not been given enough attention. And with just 15 years left to achieve that goal, he says, it is time for society to start listening. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The World Health Organization says that cholera has infected nearly 10,000 people in Tanzania since August and killed about 150. Both figures are double what they were a month ago. The WHO says the situation could get even worse with expected floods. The El Nino weather phenomenon is predicted to bring heavy rains. A chlorination campaign is underway to reduce the number of cases of the waterborne disease. However, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania's largest city, is not reported to be affected by the cholera epidemic. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
The sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
Ebola is not a curse or spiritual infection. It is a deadly disease, a fever spread by contact with the body fluids of infected people. I am Dr. Kande Greaves. If symptoms start with a fever, fatigue, and muscle pain. Within a few days, vomiting and diarrhea sets in, and victims lose about 4 liters of body fluid each day. Ebola is highly infectious. If you experience any of these symptoms, seek medical help immediately. You must wash your hands regularly. Do not eat or handle bushmeat. Stay away from people suffering from Ebola. And do not handle the bodies of Ebola victims. If you have had contact with someone who has Ebola, you need to have your temperature monitored daily for any change. Early diagnosis and treatment is critical to your survival. Learn the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The Associated Press News Service says Burkina Faso's government forces have thwarted a large-scale attack by terrorists. Malian authorities have arrested 2 men in connection with the terrorist attack that killed 22 people at an upscale Bamako hotel. And on his final day in Nairobi today, Pope Francis visited a slum and condemned what he called the injustices of urban poverty and substandard living conditions. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our features segment, children being forced to marry in immigrant communities in the United States. I'm Yehiz Wuhim, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with the mighty Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Yehiz.
So what's on the menu today?
Well, Yehiz, we have a lot of news in athletics and football. Thanks very much, Yehiz. Let's begin with athletics. The All-Russian Athletics Federation has chosen not to contest sanction and will instead cooperate with the IAAF in hope of being reinstated for Rio 2016. Russia was fully suspended from World Athletics for accepting an indefinite ban from the sport. The All-Russian Athletics Federation chose not to contest such a sanction at what would have been a hearing into the matter next month. Russia has already been provisionally suspended by the International Association of Athletics Federations over a sports worst drug scandal. Faced with a fully-fledged ban that would see Russian athletes kicked out of next year's World Indoor Championships, the Russian Federation decided to cooperate with the IAAF in the hope of regaining membership of the IAAF in time for the Olympics. The IAAF said in a statement issued during its council meeting in Monaco that the Russian Federation confirmed they understood that council would only accept their reinstatement as an IAAF member following the recommendation of the International Federation's inspection team, who will decide if the verification criteria have been fulfilled. The IAAF was expected to announce later today what Russia would have to do in order to regain membership. But the governing body has already confirmed the earliest it could do so would be after March's World Indoors in Portland. Russia was provisionally suspended almost 2 weeks ago at an emergency IAAF council meeting after being found guilty of state-sponsored doping that sabotaged a London 2012 by an independent World Anti-Doping Agency commission. In another development, US's Ashton Eaton and Ethiopia's Genzebe Dibaba were named the male and female IAAF World Athletes of the Year for 2015 on Thursday. Both athletes set world records during 2015, Eaton in decathlon and Dibaba in the 1500 meters, and won gold medals in these events at the IAAF World Championships Beijing 2015. For more on this, let's go to Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Hello, Mark.
Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba is the 2015 World Female Athlete of the Year. The IAAF revealed in Monaco on Thursday, Dibaba set a world indoor 5,000-meter record of 14 minutes and 18.86 seconds in Stockholm, Sweden. She went on to establish a new outdoor 1500-meter world record of 3 minutes and 50.07 seconds in Monaco. Dibaba crowned the year with a gold medal in 1500 meters at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. Meanwhile, Ethiopia's Almaz Ayana was presented with the IAAF Golden Shoe Award presented by Adidas. The award is for the most outstanding performance at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, where she won the 5000 meters in 14 minutes and 26.33 seconds ahead of Genzebe Dibaba. Still in Monaco, Kenya's Olympic and World Championship 3000-meter steeplechase champion Ezekiel Kemboi is one of six newly appointed IAAF Athletes Commission members. The commission consists of 18 members, 12 elected by their peers and 6 appointed by the IAAF. Turning to football, Somalia challenge Rwanda before defending champions Kenya tackle Zanzibar at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Awasa, some 270 kilometers south of the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa today, Friday. Elsewhere, South Sudan engage guest side Malawi as Djibouti face Sudan in Bahir Dar, some 270 kilometers north of Addis Ababa. Tomorrow, Saturday, Uganda play Burundi as Tanzania mainland engage hosts Ethiopia in Awasa. Meanwhile, South Africa challenge hosts Senegal before Zambia face Tunisia in Group A action at the start of the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in the capital Dakar tomorrow, Saturday. On Sunday, attention shifts to Group B, where the showdown between perennial rivals Algeria and Egypt will give way to the encounter between Mali and Nigeria. In Tunisia, the curtains come down on the Orange African Confederations Cup when Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel hosts South Africa's Orlando Pirates in the return leg of the final on Sunday. They drew 1-1 in the first leg last week. Finally, the Africa Women's Club Basketball Championship gets underway in Luanda, Angola today, Friday. Angola's Interclub are defending champions.
Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. Thanks, Mark. And in football, there has been changes made in scheduling of two Africa Premier Club Championships. My colleague Sunny Young caught up with our football guru, David Legg, for details on these changes.
David, let's turn to Africa's two premier club competitions, the Champions League and Confederation Cup tournaments. Some big news regarding scheduling. Can you give us some details?
That's right, Sonny. For the first time ever since these competitions began in 1964, in the case of the Champions League, a little bit later for the Confederation Cup, midweek matches are going to be staged. And the obvious reason for this is fixture congestion. In the second qualifying round, Sonny, the second legs will be played on April 19 and 20, 2016. And that's a Tuesday and a Wednesday. Now, there has been matches before in midweek, but only in emergencies when a game was postponed because of weather or maybe violence or some other reason like that. But there's never been scheduled midweek matches. And then when you get to the group stage, match days 2, 4, and 6 all have matches that are going to be played on Tuesday and Wednesday. And that's a sign, Sonny, of an ever-expanding cap fixture list. If you think about it, the CAF Under-23 Championship, which doubles up as the qualifiers for the Olympics, that's only going to finish in mid-December. And then come mid-January, we're going to have the kickoff in Rwanda of the CHAN, which is the African Nations Championship for home-based players. So essentially, there's just a four-week break. And I wouldn't be surprised, Sonny, if that four-week break decreases over time as well. The danger with these midweek matches, as we saw recently with the World Cup, is it can quite severely affect attendances. Some of the crowds are really disappointing for the World Cup matches. And I guess one of the obvious reasons is the fact that people are at work. They just, you know, you kind of go and tell the boss, sorry, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm off now to watch my favorite club playing in the CAF Champions League. I can just imagine what the reply from the boss will be. Jobs, Sonny, are scarce and they're precious in Africa, and you cannot be taking time off just to go and support your team. And the last thing we need for these African club matches is sort of virtually empty stadiums. It just doesn't do anything for the atmosphere. But I guess CAF have just run out of dates.
And speaking of dates, David, we now know the dates for the World Cup draw for Africa, in which 20 teams will be divided into five groups of four each. Break out your calendar for us, David.
Yes, Sonny, it's June the 24th, so it's a long wait till we're going to have this draw. It's going to be held at the CAF headquarters in Cairo. And just a reminder of those 20 teams that have qualified in alphabetical order. You've got Algeria, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Cape Verde. You've got Congo, Brazzaville, Cote d'Ivoire, Egypt, Gabon, Ghana, Guinea, Libya, Mali, Morocco, Nigeria, South Africa, Uganda. You've got the Democratic Republic of Congo, Senegal, Tunisia, and Zambia. And just a reminder to all our Voice of America listeners, you've got those 20 countries, probably, Sonny, on the basis of the FIFA rankings, although that has not been officially confirmed, will be put into four pots. And from those four pots, one team will be pulled out from each. So you'll have five groups of four. Each country will play its three opponents at home and away. So it's a total of six matches. And the five group winners, they are the five countries that will represent Africa at the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Now, it's going to be quite a drawn-out process because if you look at the match days, there'll be one in October 2016 and one in November 2016. And then on to 2017, you'll have one in August, September, October, and November. And when you consider, Sonny, that a couple of months ago it all began with those first-round qualifiers, jeepers, that's it's quite a drawn-out process. And, of course, form can change over time. And the other interesting thing about the draw is being held in June, that means that those two rounds of Cup of Nations matches next March, they'll be held over a period of 9 days. They now become crucial in terms of the rankings. So let's use South Africa as an example. At the moment, they would be in the bottom pot. They would be amongst the lowest seeds and at the greatest risk of getting a very difficult draw. I mean, I looked at a worst-case scenario for South Africa. I mean, they could be drawn with the likes of Ivory Coast, Tunisia, and Nigeria. I don't think that's a draw that the South Africans particularly want. But now they're going to play Cameroon home and away in March. If, and it's a big if, they were to win those two matches, there's a chance, Sonny, they could sneak up to the third pot, and that would certainly boost their chances of getting a good draw. Some countries, you know, your Ivory Coast, your Ghanas, etc., they don't really mind. They feel they're strong enough to qualify no matter who they meet. But for other countries, South Africa definitely included, the luck of the draw, I believe, is going to be absolutely critical as to their chances of making it to Russia or not. The big date, though, Sonny, June 24 in Cairo, that's when the draw will be made, and then all the debates and discussions begin as to who's likely to represent Africa in Russia.
That was our football guru, David Legg, in Johannesburg, South Africa. He spoke with my colleague, Sonny Young. And that conversation will bring us to the end of this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impuga. Sonny will be back on Monday. Now back to your highest.
Thank you, Douglas, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, children being forced to marry in immigrant communities in the United States. And next, the latest venture of a Kenyan gaming and entertainment company. But first, some music. Here is Mr. Duro of Ghana with Abiba.
Mayada, macheke, mayada, macheke, mayada, macheke, mayada,
Abiba,
mayada,
Abiba,
mayada,
Abiba,
Abiba,
mayada, very good Abiba. Konisa Abiba, Yerusa Abiba, Konisa Abiba, now I don't know what Jimmy say. Abiba, Jimmy sa, 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 sa,
Abiba,
Abiba,
Mary Bodro, and through NTRP and DC law, Yenya Clinton near the Yako High Court, President Sakura at 2C saw, you and you are, give me some more, the dead that's a tea pampa and it's raw, the Sahri de Ghana, you win the raw, defend this or seco for any football, me what did you mean, me support, Miss Laminato, take tall, no pin documentary, ya be a flaw, grab your grab, and your draw, Auntie Abraba, put on, put off, Miss Abiba, try hardcore,
Abiba, 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 very good Abiba, very good Abiba, Juju me, Abiba, Konsa Abiba, Yenosa Abiba, Konsa Abiba, Nawa Enona Jimmy say, Abiba, Jimmy sa.
Mr. Roduro of Ghana with Abiba. A non-profit in the U.S. eastern state of New Jersey says thousands of children in this country have been forced to marry adults. The group called Unchained at Last says child marriages mostly occur in immigrant communities. But as Ian Buyor reports from Washington, the issue is widespread and there are minimal legal solutions to stop it.
The minimum legal age for marriage in the United States is 18, but Frady Reese, founder of Unchained at Last, says thousands of children living in the U.S. may be the victims of forced marriages. She says it is difficult to determine how many children have been forced to marry in the United States because there are not many long-term or widespread studies.
So we're only just starting to figure out the full extent of this. But what we did at Unchained at Last recently was we retrieved data just in two states, in New York and New Jersey, on child marriage in recent years. And we were shocked to find the results that thousands of children in those states were married as young as 10 years old.
Unchained at Last used data collected by the Tahiri Justice Center an NGO that provides services to immigrant women and girls. The Tahiri Justice Center finds that between 2009 and 2011, as many as 3,000 known or suspected forced marriages happened in the United States involving girls under the age of 18. The Tahiri survey only focused on immigrants from 56 countries, including some from Africa, such as Somalia, Burkina Faso, and Sudan. But they also focused on forced marriages among American families. Reese says her organization is calling for studies to be conducted as well as legislative solutions. She says only 10 states in the U.S. have laws that specifically forbid forced marriage. The District of Columbia, Maryland, and California are among them, and at least one-third of the African immigrant population resides in their metropolitan area.
But most U.S. states do not have any such laws, and every U.S. state has exceptions under which children are allowed to get married.
Those exceptions include parental consent. Reese says even though most states have a minimum marriage age of 18, most states lower that to 16 if the child is marrying with parental consent.
And the problem with parental consent is that there's no process in place to be sure that it's not actually parental coercion. And in fact, oftentimes it is parental coercion, and there really is very little that these girls or boys can do to prevent these marriages from going forward.
Reese says another common legal exception is judicial approval. In certain states, a judge is allowed to approve a marriage and lower the age in some cases below the age of 16.
In New Jersey, for example, where Unchained is based, it lowers the age to zero. There is no minimum below which a judge can no longer approve a marriage. In New York, the minimum with judicial approval is 14 and varies by state.
Reese says there are many different reasons why some children are forced into marriage in the United States. It could be economic or to increase the family's social standing or to control the child's sexuality. Reese says there is very little that children can do to get out of these forced marriages. To make matters worse, Reese says children are often afraid to go to police out of fear they will be jailed or their parents will face prosecution. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
A Kenyan gaming and entertainment company has developed the country's first 3D video game called Nairobi X. As Lenny Ruvaga reports, one of the game's attractions is that it features scenes of the Kenyan capital.
This is Black Division Games. Today, Andrew Kagia, the lead developer, makes adjustments to Nairobi X. The game was released in June, but Kagia is enhancing the console based on feedback from gamers. Players assume the role of an elite tactical ranger who seeks to defend Kenya from an alien attack. Nairobi X has three-dimensional graphics, a first for a Kenyan game. Players have a 360-degree range of motion.
Trying to get accurate depictions of the city, there were no available blueprints, we had to take photos, and at the time photos were prohibited due to security scares in the city. At one point we got in trouble with police, we were being chased by police officers.
The 27-year-old developer says it took a year and about $10,000 to create Nairobi X.
When it came to development, there were a few technical issues, being the first game of its kind in this region. There was a lot of learning that we had to go through to get to this point.
Black Division Games says Nairobi X has generated $12,000 in revenue so far. Players pay $1 per month to access a game on their mobile phones or computers.
First of all, Nairobi X is very addictive. Also, in a walking around town, to be able to see what you saw in the game, it's such a good experience. I didn't expect this to find it locally.
The company also released a child-friendly 2D arcade game, Cuckoo Summer, this month. Both games are available in 12 African countries across major mobile operators. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Huntley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In 2009, President Barack Obama announced that under his administration, the United States would prioritize alleviating global hunger, undernutrition, and poverty. At the time, the global economic recession and rising food prices were forcing ever more people into food insecurity. So at the G8 summit in L'Aquila, Italy that year, President Obama committed an initial $3.5 billion to fight global hunger and poverty. Less than a year later, Feed the Future was born. It is an innovative initiative based on the premise that development efforts are most successful when the beneficiary countries determine their own food security needs and contribute to the effort. Led by the U.S. Agency for International Development, the initiative draws on 10 additional federal departments and agencies and investments from private sector partnerships. Today, it is clear that Feed the Future, coupled with other innovative U.S. government food security initiatives, are helping developing countries make substantial progress against hunger, poverty, and undernutrition. Last year alone, Feed the Future reached nearly 19 million households through assistance or training and helped bring new tools and technologies such as better seeds and fertilizers to nearly 7 million farmers. In fact, over the past 5 years in areas where Feed the Future works, the rate of childhood stunting, which indicates chronic malnutrition and leads to a host of developmental problems, has declined 9% in Ethiopia, 33% in Ghana, 25% in parts of Kenya, 21% in some areas of Cambodia, and 14.4% in areas of Bangladesh. Honduras and Bangladesh have seen a steep drop in poverty rates, and globally more than 12 million children receive nutrition interventions, such as vitamins and nutritional supplements, to help them grow and thrive. Much of the improvement has come as a result of Feed the Future's cooperation with a wide range of stakeholders to help smallholder farmers address the root causes of food insecurity and to increase economic opportunities. Through Feed the Future, the United States is partnering across borders and across sectors to unlock the transformative potential of agriculture, said USAID Associate Administrator Eric Postel. From Asia to the Caribbean to Africa, Feed the Future is helping raise crop yields and incomes, reduce stunting and poverty, and improve child nutrition. Going forward, USAID and our partners will continue working to ensure everyone has the nutritious food they need to lead full, healthy lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This one I judge. This one I judge.
Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Malaria kills thousands of people each year, but there are some simple things you can do to protect your family. If you can, put screens in your windows. A simple screen can keep disease-carrying mosquitoes out of your home. If you go outside, wear light-colored clothing and long pants and long sleeves, especially when it is dark and mosquitoes are most active. After it rains, empty all containers of standing water. The water in just one discarded tire can become a breeding ground for thousands of mosquitoes. Make sure your home is clear of debris and anything that holds water, including discarded cans, water containers, and rubbish. Empty containers that livestock drink from regularly so that mosquitoes cannot breed there.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.